cover Deng Xiaoping's Washington stay?
Almost. The morning
departure.
Thursday, February the 1st, I went over to Blair House to accompany the Vice Premier to the place where we're to take the helicopter to Andrews Air Force Base. And Secretary Vance came to Blair House for the same purpose. So the three of us were together. And Deng Xiaoping had been with Prince Sihanouk, and rather smugly told us that the prince was going to go to Peking. And I think at that time he had been saying he was had withdrawn from politics. And when the secretary said, "Well, that would indicate that he has maybe not permanently withdrawn from politics," and the vice premier smilingly said, "He is changing his mind," and was quite pleased. We went over to the Washington Monument grounds to take the helicopter. It was a very windy day, and as we got on the helicopter, there was the Vice Premier, Madam Jo Lin, Mr. G, Sharon, and I, and we were instructed really fasten our seat belts because it was very windy. We all did except the Vice Premier. He just threw his aside, flatly refused to fasten his seat belt. Then we went down to Dobbins Air Force Base in Atlanta. We met by Governor Busby and the welcoming ceremonies. And on the way into the hotel, the Peachtree Plaza, I rode in the car with the governor and the vice premier, Mr. G, who, of course, acted as interpreter all through that trip. And the governor was complimenting Deng Xiaoping on his television presence and he'd really become a television star to the American people. But then he added, "But I think your wife is even better." And it so happened I was watching the vice premier at this point. And his face visibly showed he was not pleased. he had been pleased to be informed he was a television star, but he was not too pleased to be informed that his wife was even better. Then we had the first of, they weren't press conferences. As you remember, he met with regional editors and publishers in the three places that he went outside Washington. As well as I can remember it, in fact, I stated in my confirmation testimony a few days later, the question of the security of Taiwan and the future of Taiwan never came up. And then there was a big...
In my files that I have deposited at the University of Michigan library, I have the transcripts of every one of Deng's press conferences while he was in the U.S. They're all available.
Oh, where are they?
Yes. They're in my files that I have deposited at the University of Michigan Historical Library.
Is that at Bentley? Or
yes, at Bentley.
At Bentley. Well, that's very interesting. And we had this huge luncheon sponsored by the Southern Center for International Studies and the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. Then I got the message that had been urgently forwarded by the White House that the Martin Luther King gravesite the Chinese had refused to put it on the list of places to go. And would I try and do something about it? And so so happened I was seated at a table where my seatmate was Ambassador Wei, who was chief of protocol for the Chinese, and who was the one who had been saying no. When I got this message, the luncheon's already underway, and right after the luncheon was the only possible time that we could have to stop at the gravesite. I also figured that I was butting my head against a stone wall because I'd been told that Ambassador Wei had been absolutely not, absolutely impossible. So I went directly to the Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping. He, of course, was seated with him and explained that how important it was that that he do this. From a political point of view, the blacks in America and the, oh, he said he was a great man. Of course I will. And right then, when I went back to my table, Mr. Wei was there, and I told him what I had done. He did not speak to me for 48 hours.
Well, you know why we had
very unhappy.
There was a bit of a tussle within the White House over that particular issue. The FBI and the Secret Service were adamant that Deng not go there because they felt that it was a very dangerous open area and that we did not wish Deng to be exposed to any moments where he would be stationary in an open area. And where there were buildings nearby. The one chance we took was the Lincoln Memorial, but we figured that there was no tall buildings, and so it would take someone in the bushes.
That was against the background, of course, of threats about which I had no knowledge at that time.
Right.
But it certainly would have been politically difficult for President Carter had such a prominent state guest in Atlanta bypassed that, and of course the event went absolutely without.
Coretta King was it was masterful in using the media, and she particularly indicated that she would publicly protest if he did not come. She had put great pressure on the administration to make sure that...
Yes, it was Coretta King and Jose Williams and others who were doing even more vociferous. Of course, Coretta was at the luncheon because after the vice premier said, of course I will, I first told her before I went back to my table and told Mr. Wei. Then we visited the Ford assembly plant in Atlanta. Henry Ford came down for that visit. Douglas Fraser, my successor as president of the UAW, was also there. The vice premier seemed to be very interested in the assembly process. We rode through on carts, motorized carts, and stopped at various places. Then after we came out, in the car going back to the hotel, there was Fraser and myself accompanied him, and he said, "Tell me, what do you and the employers, what do you union people and the employers talk about when you meet?" So I deferred to Doug to answer that. Then that night, Governor Busby gave a banquet for the vice premier and his party, 16 other governors. They supposedly were having a meeting of the executive committee or council of the National Governors Association. And there was a meeting prior to going into dinner. Afterwards, the Chinese joked about the 17 salesmen because each made a pitch each. They didn't all get a chance to talk. There wasn't enough time. Those who did, and there were quite a few of them, made a pitch about the products, the commerce, the agriculture of his state, and the Chinese, I think, found that quite amusing. Then at the dinner, when the governor asked him if there was anything he found unique about America, his rejoinder was, yes, veal at every meal. he had been served veal at so many places. I think veal was served that night in Atlanta.
Yes, that's right. He had veal on three nights in a row.
It was served in the Senate. White House. It was served at the United States China People's Friendship Association dinner, as I remember it. And then the fourth time was in Atlanta.
Well, the reason is that we had, I think, two or three requirements given to us by Chinese protocol. The first is that Deng Xiaoping wished to sleep in a single bed, that he wanted two single beds, not want to sleep in a double bed. And they specified the hardness of the mattress on which he liked to sleep. Second, what the room temperature was to be for him. I think it was 71. And third, that he was to have no hot, spicy dishes served, and that his doctors wished for him essentially to have bland food.
And veal meant that specification.
And that's how it was interpreted. Everyone chose to mean that his bland food was veal.
There was one other in Atlanta. They were up on the 78th floor, I think, or in the 70s anyway. And Sharon went up with Madame Jolin, and she said they were very nervous about being so high. I suppose they didn't think about that when they laid down all their specifications, or that would have been added.
That's right, that's probably the tallest building he had ever been in.
And she said to Sharon that, that this building seems to be swaying. And so Sharon said, well, that's possibly true, but they're built to do that, because that makes... That's not a problem. That's the way it's supposed to be, which was a good answer. And in Houston, we were in a high floor. But in Seattle, we were on somewhat lower floors.
About the 30. It was not as high at the hotel. That's right. But all of them were new, and two of them were circular hotels.
Right. She made it quite clear they were not at all comfortable being so high. Then the next day, the 2nd of February, we left from Dobbins Air Force Base to go into Ellington Air Force Base in Houston, the inevitable welcoming ceremony, and went then directly to the LBJ Space Center at NASA.
Governor Clement came out. That took a great deal of arm twisting by Bob Strauss, as I'm sure you heard, to get the governor. He refused to roll out a red carpet for him. In Georgia, there was a red carpet. In Seattle, there was a red carpet. But Clement showed his distaste for having a communist visit him by keeping the red carpet away.
Did the Chinese notice that?
I don't think so.
I never heard any comment about it. And certainly, Deng Xiaoping was fascinated by the Space Center. Remember when he was in that simulated vehicle, apparently coming in for the landing. He was so gleeful that I think he would have been willing to stay there all day. And we had lunch out there, and then went to the hotel. And at that point, he'd earned a long rest. But then that night, it was raining, and the long trip through heavy traffic. Of course, the small caravan that Deng Xiaoping was in had a police escort, but the rest of us in buses didn't.
Monumental traffic jam.
It was a Friday night, made it worse. But some of the Chinese suddenly realized that our traffic did not move exactly the way it had been moving up until then.
Well, in fact, I learned later, we were caught in the traffic jam partly caused, or largely caused, by his motorcade.
But we got there ahead of him.
I thought we were... I came after him, I thought.
I see. Maybe
you went ahead. I came after
Our bus was there ahead because they then proudly showed me the 101 cowboy hats they had. And my first reaction, I stated, I don't think the Chinese will wear these. Well, I was so wrong. They loved them, including the vice premier. And when he went around in that stagecoach around the Rodeo area, and was again the consummate politician, really enjoying it, and they were almost ecstatic with the barbecue meal they got. And that was spicy.
Yes, that's right. And he was delighted at last.
He certainly was delighted. And then, of course, he seemed also to very much enjoy the rodeo.
Well, you were with him quite a bit during this trip in informal exposure to him. What were some of the human qualities to Deng that you observed? I mean, did he relax? Is he a talkative fellow?
Very relaxed. Not necessarily. Not a compulsive talker by any means. For example, on the ride back from the Brzezinski's after the dinner, when of course he was very tired, we rode for long stretches without talking. He was not asleep, but not a compulsive talker, but very, very relaxed. Did not make a person feel ill at ease, or if there was a silence, there was no feeling on my part that, my God, I got to think of something to say to fill this void. It wasn't that kind of a silence. And if he were an American, I'd say he was very democratic. That was the impression one got. And, of course, I'd noticed that before with his Chinese colleagues. I'm sure he could, if he wanted to be very tough and demanding, but normally he was he acted very much as one does with equals, and did not pull rank. And that was certainly true on this trip. Fang Yi, I was with Fang Yi quite a bit too, particularly in the Washington portion of it. And he of course is a relatively quiet and I would say almost unassuming person. Certainly he's that when he's around Deng Xiaoping, but he's not very assertive. The most animated I've ever seen Fang Yi is when he talks about certain beauty spots of China, when he can get almost lyrical. You haven't been there, he would say to me. Oh! He would wave his hands. And Madame Jo Lin, and she got along very well with Sharon. Of course, Sharon already knew quite well Madame Li Li Diang,
Huang
Hua's wife. And I think we commented on Fang Yi's wife, who was so retiring and almost shrinking. Sharon had made a particular point of trying always to get her included. But the whole party was very relaxed. It was a very enjoyable occasion. Neither Sharon nor I ever had the feeling that, well, this is a duty, and we're worried about it, and we'll be glad when it's over. We enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, he certainly enjoyed it. We'll talk about the whole trip and impressions of it as we take off from Washington.
And then the next day, he met with the regional editors and publishers at a breakfast at the hotel. And then we visited the Hughes Tool Company. That was sort of a lackadaisical thing. I imagine Hughes Tool was on the list because of the commercial application.
Petroleum.
Tool bits.
Well, we wanted to. Enormous amount of time went into, as I'm sure you can imagine, thinking through the reason for every factory visit. And here was to highlight the potential energy connection between China and the U.S., hope that we'd get some TV play on China's potential as an oil producer.
And then it was a relatively short visit to the Hughes Tool Company. He did not seem particularly interested because the machining operations were not as spectacular as an automobile assembly line that he'd seen in Atlanta. And he went back to the hotel for lunch and a long rest. And we left in mid-afternoon for Seattle and arrived at Boeing Field at about 5:30.
We nearly had a stop in Iowa.
what was that about?
We decided just to get him someplace in the Midwest and get him to rural America, have some TV shots of Deng Xiaoping on a farm, but we couldn't fit it in.
Well, that was not done on the way, I mean, earlier.
No,
that,
we had thought very carefully to make a fourth stop and decided that the man deserved some rest.
And then he had went to the Washington Plaza Hotel, where they were on a much lower floor, and he had the night off, as I remember it.
That's right. One night off. I don't remember which was the night off. I think we arrived the night off. That's right.
Right, because we didn't get in until
late.
It was close to 7 by the time we got to the hotel. And then you had the great idea of inviting Zhang Wenjin and a few other Chinese out to dinner. We went to Ray's Boathouse and had a great dinner and a wonderful
evening.
Marvelous evening. Zhang Wenjin was very talkative. And, the relaxed atmosphere in that dinner was a very special example of the relaxation that one figured all the way through. I've still been trying to think what it was in Atlanta that I had to take up with Wang Hua. It had to be Prince Sihanouk. He had given a press interview. What would it have been about? It probably would have been about, at that point it couldn't, probably about Cambodia. And I was instructed to talk to the foreign minister to see if he couldn't restrain the prince from talking about such things, which I did. He just shrugged his shoulders and said, he's a very talkative man. There's not much we can do with him. Which subsequently, of course, proved to be very true. But that night at dinner at Ray's Boathouse, very good.
And it was there, too, that we set forth, if you remember, what each side would be working hard on for the rest of the
right.
year.
Yeah, it was more than a social occasion.
It was, we went over the Carter-Dunn meeting on the bilateral relationship and talked about the Blumenthal trip, about the Krebs trip. In effect, set the informal agenda for the development of our economic relationship, for our cultural relations. We had hoped for a John Reinhart visit. That did not come off. And I also think that we spoke elliptically about a major U.S. visit to China, if not the president, the vice president, sometime toward the end of the year or the early part of 1980.
Yes, I think we did. Then the next day we took a hydrofoil tour of Puget Sound, the hydrofoil being a Boeing product. The vice premier did not go on that trip because by this time he was running a slight fever.
That's right.
And there was a reception and luncheon that was put on by the Washington the Businessman and the National Committee for U.S.-China Trade at in the hotel in the Grand Ballroom, which was not as big as the Atlanta luncheon, but also quite impressive.
Scoop, Warren Magnuson, Governor Ray, all vying for prominence, too.
Right. And then we went out to Everett to tour the Boeing 747 plant, which, for security reasons that I didn't quite understand at the time, but I now obviously understand. At that time, Boeing was working 7 days a week on the 747. But the only people working that day were those who were involved in the operations, which were to be shown to the vice premier. Otherwise, the plant was
shut down.
Was deserted. It was shut down. And when I asked why, I was told by the Boeing people, security reasons. I thought they meant their own security reasons, which didn't make much sense to me, but obviously was the concern because of the threats. But here again, the vice president was very interested in the operation. And I must say, so was I, because the technological developments in airframe assembly advanced greatly from what I had seen only just a few years before, with computer applications of the weddings that were taking place of the various component parts, and really a remarkable thing. I saw the Boeing plant again, the same 747 plant at Everett last fall, but their production pace has slowed so much that you get a much different impression today if you see it than we saw on that February day in 1979, when I think there were, I forget how many of those ships, those huge ships they were putting out every month, but it was a big number.
It was, and yeah.
Then that night they had the reception at the Kenley's restaurant with a beautiful view of Seattle and the
steak dinner, steak and lobster, whatever is beautiful.
Right. And when we had the cocktails beforehand, and they asked the vice premier what he would have, you remember he said, Coca-Cola, I guess I'm going to have to learn to like it. But that was a very put on by Seattle businessman, but not a huge dinner, but
elegant.
A very elegant dinner.
Dung was by that time running the temperature, and he was, I think he called the dinner to a short end, if I recall, because he was ill.
Yes, right. And then the next morning, there was a 7:30 breakfast with, again, the regional editors and publishers that the vice premier did not make because of his
Wang Hua, I think. Yeah.
Wang Hua substituted for him. And then that we went out to Boeing Field for the little after 9 o'clock for the farewell ceremony. Was obviously not feeling well, but for the last ceremony, I think we moved it indoors because of our concern for his health, and then that took only 20 minutes or so, and then their plane left, and we flew back to Andrews Air Force Base. But it was really a great visit.
Yeah. What impression do you think Deng had, and what did he learn about the United States as a result of this trip?
I sometimes wonder what anyone can learn. You know, you see so many well-managed staged events. They don't see reality, and not knowing the country, I think, is why I say they don't see reality. I remember riding with Fong Yi, and we were rolling down the Rock Creek Parkway in Washington because all the entrances were closed until we were through. Oh, he said, we have so much to learn from you controlling traffic. And as I understood him, he thought that we had it this way all the time. So I explained that I don't think he meant in the sense of controlling for a state purpose, because they can teach us a few things about that. So I explained that this is not the way it was normally. And I think the Chinese, the other Chinese got the same impression by their comments, the big traffic jams that we experienced in Houston on the way out to Simonton. I'm thinking, too, of when Boy Bo came to this country, and when he got back to Peking, he was here for several weeks, a few weeks anyway. He gave a dinner for the Canadians and Americans who'd been involved in his visit. And before we sat down to dinner, Sharon said to him, "Was there any particular thing that impressed you in the United States, Mr. Vice Premier?" And, "Oh, yes," he said, "as a communist and a Marxist, I went there expecting to find a society falling apart. And system not working. I didn't find that at all. I found entrepreneurs and financiers who are hard at work in control of events. I found workers diligent at their tasks." As an old trade unionist, I almost wrote that down on a piece of paper and asked him to sign it. And to speak in such glowing terms. Now, yes, that is America, but it isn't America at the same time. He had a much more leisurely visit, whereas Deng's visit was so telescoped, it was one event rushing upon another, that it obviously had a great impression on him. But how much he subsequently could sort out, I'm very curious about. When Kissinger was in China, and Deng gave the dinner, small dinner for him, and I was invited. And Kissinger said to Deng, "Are you going to make any more foreign trips, Mr. Vice Premier, when will you make more foreign trips? He said, oh, I don't think I'll make any more. My comrades don't want me to travel. He made that statement before, but then he added, when I went to the United States and Japan, that filled all my ambitions, which I thought was a very telling comment. He had come back from Japan, obviously extremely pleased, and I think he, without question, was extremely pleased with his visit to the United States. And I think he had a very, I think it was a very affirmative reaction that he had. And I think despite all our comments before and subsequently about the weakness of our will and so on, I think he got an impression of strength that I hope he still remembers in the current crisis.
You will remember that he had many conversations with American politicians on the airplane. We carefully brought on board almost all members of the cabinet who joined. They flew to Houston and ordered separately in order to be on the plane from Houston to Seattle. We also brought a large number of congressmen, senators on board the plane who would join Deng for short conversations. I wasn't present for any of those. What were those conversations like?
I wasn't present for any of them either. I deliberately hung back because the space in the cabin was limited, and it was more important to have someone else whose only chance it would be to see and talk with the vice premier.
In any case, he, in the course of that, using the plane judiciously as it is meant to be, he must have had exposure to about 30 to 40 American politicians.
I would think so, yes. Judging from the Americans, many of whom spent a little time with me afterwards, those visits went extremely well. The Americans certainly were very pleased. And talking to Mr. G, he said... reaction was they went very well. I'd be more inclined to think he would say that in any event, but his comments plus the comments of some of the Americans, I think they had very positive effects. And of course, from our standpoint, it was very good to give as big an exposure as possible to key politicians so that the boogaboo of the Red Chinese could be diminished.
Right.
So, back in Washington,
we flew back together. Right. I remember an Ambassador Chai. We flew back on the president's plane as Deng took off on his own plane from Seattle. He, around the United States, flew in President Carter's plane.
Right.
And came back. We were all exhilarated and exhausted, I remember.
Secretary Berglund was on that plane.
That's right. Number of congressmen.
Tom Foley.
That's right.
Was then head of the
Agriculture
Committee.
House Agriculture.
House Agriculture Committee, excuse me. And there were two or three other congressmen on that plane.
From what? From the Washington
delegation?
From
the state of Washington, right. In fact, I think the entire Washington delegation was in Seattle.
That's right. They all came back.
But they didn't all come back on that plane. And neither Scoop Jackson nor...
Magnuson were on the plane. No, neither one.
Neither, no. Well, they were staying for the...
But we had a pile of Chinese in addition to Chai. I think all the Washington-based people who went around with Deng, Wang Hongbao, Cao Guisheng, were on the plane. I remember singing songs
I was greatly relieved when Dunk took off, given the worries that I was just, I thought, great, he's gone.
Yeah, well, of course, you had much keener and real worries than I had. So I just had a deep sense of satisfaction
yeah.
that it had gone so
yeah.
well.
Yeah, well, that I had.
I didn't have the additional relief of fear that you had. Well, I had it, but only to a very, to a very small extent. So back in Washington, I note that Monsignor George Higgins of the Catholic Church. I don't suppose you know him, but he's been the sort of Catholic delegate to the labor movement in the United States for many, many years. Was chairman of the UAW's Public Review Board. At that time, still is. And he arranged a meeting in the embassy room, in the Embassy Row Hotel, for a group of Catholic bishops to discuss the new China connection. And there were a large number of representatives of the Catholic bishops at this luncheon. And we had a very interesting and, I think, very productive discussion, which I think had some profitable political consequences. And I know, too, that I had a session that afternoon with Albert Gore, former senator from Tennessee, in his new capacity as representing Occidental Petroleum.
He just went to China.
Just went to China at that time. What did I think? Could they make an approach to the Chinese, or would their would Hammer's long association with the Soviet Union be a roadblock? I said, no, I didn't think so. That they certainly should pursue it, which of course they may have done. Then on the morning of the 7th, in Gary Hart's office, I met with him and with Senator Baucus of Montana, Carl Levin of my own state of Michigan, and Bill Bradley, the new senator from New Jersey. It was after that session was over that Gary Hart had arranged. Gary and I were alone. He took me over to the map in his office and pointed out the places in Iran that we had lost. And what did I think were the possibilities of replicating those in China, pointing to the map, saying that it's his information, that they would even be better for that purpose, and that these were essential, in his opinion, to the ratification of SALT II.
What did you say?
As I remember it, I said that I thought on the Chinese side, they would be receptive if it were handled properly. And and I think I put some cautionary words if it was sold to them on the proposition of it being necessary for SALT II, that it would not necessarily get an affirmative response. It would have to be on broader grounds than that. But they certainly would have an interest in what's going on in the Soviet Union from their own purposes. Then the next day, I had my confirmation hearing in by this time there was no opposition to me on a personal basis. There was an opposition by some led by Jesse Helms, that nothing should be done until the shape of the Taiwan legislation was at least agreed or, in fact, in place. And Jesse, of course, as I remember it, put a hold on Adiba either then, that morning, or shortly thereafter. And as I came out of that hearing, there was some business with the papers I was supposed to have filed that were